We're going to have an agenda today for the rehab committee. We're going to be the rehab committee for California Council of the Blind, and then we're going to change it to California Council of the Blind Deaf because of that speaker. But anyway, so today we're going to have Frank go through these consumer surveys with us that they did at the last convention. And the NFB folks did them too. And it was done with consumers regarding the Department of Rehabilitation. We are bracing ourselves, Frank, okay? We got it braced here. But, you know, many of us, you know, we all work at the Department of Rehab that are here today. I just became a supervisor in Blindfield Services. Teresa's a great counselor. I'm sorry. I'm Trisha Leitz. And Teresa next to me here, Teresa Gardner, she's a rehab counselor, a great one. And we have Debbie here, and she's a Debbie Bacon, and she's an intern with us, and she's excellent. And we have Ed Crespin, and we just lost one of our favorites, Richard Ruetta, to the Lighthouse.
Yeah.
And that's... And Mr. Bashan, we're very proud of him. He's the new director of the Lighthouse, and we're very proud of you. We have Mr. Miller in the room, too. And he audits us, so you guys, this is... So I think the folks, the director's calling in from the Commissions for the Blind today. They'll be shocked to hear that Mr. Miller's in the room too. So, but I think, you know, what we really want to do here is we do want to be involved with the California Council of the Blind. Many of us from the Department of Rehabilitation, because we know that being down with the people is really where it's at, and we need to listen to the people and how they feel about services and how can we be better. And that's what the program is about today in general. It's about listening to Frank, seeing what we can do to be better, listening to programs out there that are commissions for the blind that are considered many times better for employment outcomes than divisions or generalist programs. So we'll find out a little more about them, though. You know, we'll get the real dirt. And we have to make it exciting somehow, a little juicy here, people. You guys are like, why did we come unless this was going to be? So, anyway, with that, I'd like to introduce Frank Welty. He is the advocate, lobbyist for the California Council of the Blind. He's fantastic. He's one of my very favorite people. And he is such a great advocate for all of us, always working so hard. And Frank is going to go through the survey, and I'm just going to, I'm going to take it for the team today, Frank. I'm going to do it.
Very good.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me get started here. Since the adoption of SB 105, which created a division of specialized services for individuals who are blind or visually impaired and deaf or hard of hearing within the Department of Rehabilitation, the department has submitted reports to the legislature every 2 years on the success of the division. These reports show steady increases in the number of clients who have become employed and increases in the average wage earned. Consumer organizations and private agencies serving individuals who are blind or visually impaired have heard much less favorable reports. But to that end, the California Council of the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind of California, and members of the California Agencies for the Blind and Visually Impaired jointly developed a survey geared to gather information from clients of the Department of Rehabilitation who are blind or visually impaired to assist with the assessment of the status of the Blindfield Services District and to determine whether consumers are satisfied with the services. The survey was conducted during the fourth quarter of 2009. CCB and NFBC encouraged attendees at their respective conventions to participate in the survey, and they took other steps to promote this activity. CAPV members' agencies also participated in this effort. Survey responses were compiled and analyzed by Camilla Ruding and Frank Welty in the CCB office. A total of 82 survey responses were included in our analysis. Some other survey responses forms were received, but they were excluded from the analysis because they appeared to contain bogus data. Because the survey was intended to measure the performance of blind field services, since it was organized pursuant to SB 105, we tried to distinguish survey responses that reported on individuals who received services during the time period in which BFS has been in existence from those survey responses that reported on the experiences of individuals whose contact with DOR preceded the formation of BFS. 66 responses came from individuals served by BFS since 2004. The survey group, I refer to that as the survey group.
The 66.
The 66, yes. And 16 responses came from individuals whose contact with DOR ended prior to 2004. We have used this later group of responses as a control group for the purposes of our analysis. Because respondents weren't all careful to clearly state the time period of their involvement with DOR, we had to rely on some inference to determine which responses belonged in the survey group and which ones belonged in the control group. According to our survey, it appears that BFS has made improvements in the percentage of respondents who have received the following services: development of a plan of service, provision of options regarding training and education pathways, assessment of interests and skills, pre-employment training, assistance with job search skills, provision of job leads, training on discussing reasonable accommodation, technology assessment, training on the agreed-upon technology required for a successful job search. Let's see. Attentive, helpful rehabilitation counselor. It appears that BFS has experienced declines in the percentages of respondents who have received the following services: successful plan completion, receipt of support from DOR needed to successfully complete training or education goals, assistance to develop a resume, receipt of the equipment necessary to conduct successful job search and to be successful on the job in a timely manner. I should mention parenthetically that perhaps some of the reason for some of those declines may be that certain individuals may still be in plan, so it may just be that they weren't far enough to receive those particular services. The fact that a large number of the rehabilitation activities included in the survey showed improvements over time is good news. However, it is also true that the survey results show that there is much room for improvement in all of these activities. The overall level of client satisfaction in the survey group averaged 3.61 on a scale of 1 to 5. Has only improved slightly over the average level of client satisfaction in the control group, 3.5. This unimpressive satisfaction level is reflected in the percentage of clients who stated that their expectations had to be met, about 63% in the survey group versus 56% in the control group. The selection of comments shown in our survey, we also got individual comments, and I should mention that those provided additional insights into the experiences of BFS clients. Many clients received quality services from BFS, and they achieve successful outcomes. However, others fail to receive the services they need, or they don't receive services from BFS in a timely manner. Client feedback, such as that which we have gathered through this survey, is a valuable tool for evaluating the quality of service provided by Blind Field Services District of the Department of Rehabilitation. We encourage DOR and other BFS stakeholders to consider the results of this survey and to seek additional BFS client feedback in the future. I would mention that in the written survey, this executive summary that I just read was followed by a listing of all of the questions with the breakdowns on the answers, yes, no, or not applicable, and then for the the survey group and the control group, I thought that going through that would be beyond the scope of this particular presentation, but if people want me to send that to them, I can. Also, we had a listing of selected comments from individuals, which ran the gamut from these people were great, they were helpful, if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be able to support my family, to these were terrible, they lied to me, they wrote down a plan I didn't agree to. It was so you sort of had a whole range of responses, and those responses that we did get were really insightful in terms of giving us background into why people responded the way they did in the rest of the survey. And I think the bottom line is that, again, the survey did show that that there are areas of strength in BFS, but that there is room for improvement. I think it also showed the value of incorporating client feedback in a meaningful way into the process, so that as we go along, we can get real-world feedback from clients as to how things are going in the department, and I think that would be a very helpful thing to do on an ongoing basis, and hopefully CCB can continue to be involved with that.
Yeah.
So we have time, so if people would like to ask any questions or make comments, I think that would be good.
I'm going to work on the pump system also.
Okay.
Right?
Yes, yes, Judy.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what kind of results
we did not break down survey results by the source of the survey. In other words, we collected survey results were forwarded to our office and consolidated. So we have some from different places. So some from NFBC, some from CCB, some from CABD agencies, but we did not identify where the responses came from. These are the totals. Correct, yes.
Do you know if anybody else has done an analysis as well, or did you and...
We did the analysis in behalf of the participants, yes. And we presented those analysis reports at the last Blind Advisory Committee for DOR.
I'm sorry to hog, but I have
no problem.
A question.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically, what can we say about the validity of such a relatively small pool?
Well, we did have more than 30 respondents, so that by that standard, the figures are statistically significant.
More than 30,
at the mathematical level, 30 generally counts as sufficient to be a valid survey, assuming all things being equal. Pardon?
What was the return rate?
I don't know the number that actually went out, because we didn't mail out surveys. What we did is the way we collected our surveys was we had people at the two conventions gathering surveys, but also we had set up a page on our website where people could fill out the form online. So I think we got a lot of forms coming in that way. So in terms of we couldn't say, we sent out 800 forms and we got back 150 or something like that.
Can I say something really quick?
Yes.
Last year when I was here at the same meeting, Brian Connors got up and talked about the survey, and I asked him how he was disseminating the information, because that was my concern. My past experience with getting information out to this client base, it's very difficult. And I said, how are you doing it? Are you doing phone contacts? Are you doing email contacts? What are you doing? And one of the barriers that we had, again, is the same old issue, the privacy issue. So, and Catherine Bells was in the room, and I said, is there a way that we can disseminate the information to the counselors, have them get that out to the clients so that there's a larger respondent base? And there was a very wishy-washy response.
Be careful.
Yeah. So, that was my concern. That was my concern, that the clients weren't even knowing that there was a survey out there for them to utilize.
I could respond to that if you like.
I would love you to respond to that.
That was actually an issue at a recent SRC meeting about the next survey.
And, right.
What we decided to do to make sure that...
Is this Brian Basher or Brian?
No, Brian Connors.
That's Brian Connors.
Yeah.
from who's the chair of the rehabilitation, the state rehabilitation council.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't mean to be so sarcastic.
No, that's okay. That's cool. Go ahead. I didn't know you were in the room.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's okay. Yeah, that was an issue that I was very adamant about this year before we sent out this year's survey. And so what we decided upon was that if we were going to send out, actually we're sending out more surveys than last year. We're sending out 4,000. And we're sending them out both by email and by mail. All surveys that are not delivered via email will be sent out, definitely be sent out by mail as well. So in other words, everybody, if there is a bad email address, it will not be, then another one will be followed.
There's a backup plan.
Now,
everybody, it's guaranteed that everybody will receive a service.
Now, Brian, I'm presuming that you're talking about the internal DOR survey, is that right? As opposed to this survey that we conducted?
Yeah, and that's a good point. Yeah, this is a totally separate survey.
Oh, mm-hmm. It is.
I would make the comment that we certainly did make a good faith effort to reach out. We publicized the survey as best we could, and I'm sure that NFBC did the same to the extent that they could. Certainly, the more response you can get, the better. But at the very least, I think that this provides I think there's enough that while you certainly might not want to base, say, legislation on this or something like that, that it certainly does still give you a window into what consumers are feeling and a benchmark against which we could do future surveys. So I think I would consider that a good start, but by all means, the more the merrier.
I also wanted to add, we're also adding the survey online, so it's not restricted to just the people that...
Good.
Yeah, and that's good. But yes, you're...
My survey?
No.
Yeah, the customer satisfaction survey is it's a department sponsored survey. That the State Rehabilitation Council works with the department on it. So it's kind of a partnership to send that out.
Now, Brian, when is that due to come out?
I'm not sure exactly what date it is.
Okay, but soon or within the year?
I think it's going to be sent out, I want to say, in May.
Now, is that an internal document or is that a public record?
Public record. Yeah.
Or we could look at that.
The other stipulation was that the results would come out in time for us to post the results in our next annual report.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me now?
Okay.
I'm sorry. And, it'll be submitted to RSA.
We can hear you fine.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Brian.
Okay, you guys, let me just announce a couple of people that came online here. Hi, Pearl. Hi, Greg. Are you on?
I am here.
Yay. We have Greg Trapp, who is the director of the New Mexico Commission for the Blind, and we also have Pearl Van Zandt, who is the director of the Commission for the Blind in Nebraska, on here. We're just having a lively discussion. We had a survey done on the Department of Rehabilitation Blind Field Services, and not so glowing. And we are here having a lively discussion about it all. And we want to have you guys chime in to talk about the Commissions for the Blind because, you know, maybe there's ways that we can improve through being educated on other structures that can work better for serving consumers. So,
So what kind of format can we best use to
do this? We're gonna ask interview questions to you, but right now, do you guys want to ask some more questions from the audience? If you guys could just hang in there with us, and then we'll step right into you guys, if that's okay.
Hey, Brian Miller.
Yeah, Brian Miller.
Okay.
I was curious.
It's Brian Miller speaking from the RSA. He's here.
Hi, Greg. Hi, Pearl.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Greg's probably wondering, is this guy everywhere?
It's a trick.
I'm curious. I saw that the
Hello.
I saw that the draft state plan came out this week. I think at least I saw a copy of it this week. I was curious to know if the survey that you all conducted managed to make it to either the SRC or to the folks at DORA that put the plan together in time for them to incorporate some of the findings into the plan.
Huh? Yeah, we presented the survey at the last meeting of the Blind Advisory Committee to BFS. That was last month, and I did transmit a copy of that survey right immediately after that to Catherine Bales. So it certainly was available to DOR to consider. Now, whether their time frames were such that was early enough for them to include that in their plan, I can't say, but at least they have received our survey. And by the way, I would mention that, and Trish, you can tell me if I'm out of line here, but I think if people would like to see our full survey report, if they contact me at the CCB office, I could certainly email them a copy. You can call the CCB office at 800-221-6359, or you can send me email at frank.welty, that's W-E-L-T, like telephone, E, at ccbnet.org.
You're never out of line. You're one of my favorite people.
Thank you.
Any more questions, you guys? We could jump right into having our interviews with the directors from the Commission for the Blind.
Thank you.
Okay. It's not really a question. It's a statement. I think a lot of clients through the DOR have to realize that it's a partnership between the client and DOR. I know a lot of people in Riverside that complain about what DOR doesn't do. These are the same people that when they have Job Club, if a job bit them in the face, they wouldn't take it. You know, these are people that are not taking any kind of training or anything or trying to put forth any effort and stuff. I know my counselor, Kathy Barnes, and her supervisor, Candace Marlowe, has been great trying to help me and a lot of people achieve their goals, you know.
That's good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes fear eats us up alive, you know. Sometimes that's the underlying thing that keeps people, too, from moving forward. I try to see the... underneath it all sometimes to see what's really going on. But, you know.
But I think blind field services need to clean house sometimes because people that were sitting in Job Club 3 years ago and haven't taken any training, hasn't accepted a job or anything, why are they still receiving transportation money and half the time they don't show up for Job Club or anything?
So you guys don't have any clients like that in Nebraska or New Mexico, right?
I really couldn't hear.
Oh.
My silence did not mean
you didn't hear the what he was asking. What was your name?
Oh, Bessie.
There was a person. Her name is Bessie in the audience.
Okay. So Bessie was just saying that she was saying that that the many of the clients that are in her area are not working in partnership that well with the Department of Rehab or in our blind field services. That she was basically just saying that, you know, when they wouldn't know a job, jobs are offered, but they're not taking them, and they'd rather get their transportation checks. And I was just saying that, you know, sometimes fear eats people alive, too. That's what keeps people back many times, too. Because I think our job is to always try to figure out what really is the barrier and to keep going like that if we can. And yet, you know, it is a partnership, and you're very right. And I was just teasing you guys that you don't have any clients that are they're all easy and they're all simple, right?
Of course.
Every one of them. Yep. But I know we have Therese and Debbie here. Therese is a counselor at the Department of Rehab. I'm a supervisor there. And Debbie is an intern with us there. And we have some interview questions for you guys, for our audience. I'll tell you a little bit who's in the audience. We have many rehab counselors in the audience, and we have people who are consumers, members of the California Council of the Blind. We have Brian Bashan, the director of the Lighthouse. We have Brian Miller, who is from RSA, as you guys know. And we have Joe Smith. What a simple name. I can't believe I forgot it. And he works with us at the Department of Rehabilitation also. He's done a lot of systems analysis and statistical work with us, and he works in the central office, and he's been an active member for years too. But that's just an idea of who's in the audience.
Great. And Brian Basham, congratulations on your new position.
Thanks, Greg.
And we also have some people too that work in the nonprofits and rehab as well. And we have about 4,000 people in the room, just so you know, so don't get scared.
How you tell us? Well, I know that Pearl and I both look forward to this, and I think we'll have a lot of common approaches here.
Why don't I start with the first question, and then Deb and Teresa jump in too. What everybody always says that the commissions for the blind are so best for employment outcomes. Is that true? And how do you achieve it if it's true?
Which one do you want to take that one first? Which one of us do you want to take that one first?
Either one can go. Which you want to take it, Pearl, or what are you thinking?
Go ahead, Greg. Jump in and then.
Okay.
Well, it's an excellent question because I think it depends on how you measure the employment outcome. And to boil it down into a simplistic approach, there are two measurements. One is obviously the rehab rate, the percentage of outcomes that are resulting in a successful employment. And then there are measurements that pertain to the quality of that outcome. For example, the starting wage. And I feel that it really requires a balance. I think that as we respect the informed choice provisions of the Rehab Act, that we will approve plans that honor those informed choice, the plan being consistent with the individual strengths, resources, capabilities, priorities, and informed choice. And that might have an outcome that might be less likely to succeed. It might, when it does succeed, result in a higher starting wage. So I think that you see separate agencies for the blind, commissions for the blind, often having higher wages, but often also having lower rehab rates. And it depends on where you put the priority. And I think that empowering individuals to make choices and then providing the services so that they can obtain that career choice, which we guide, obviously, and if it was something that was possible, certainly we would not serve that individual. If it was an individual whose goal was to become a jet fighter pilot, obviously, I'm using a little hyperbole to illustrate the point. I think, too, that we want to make sure that we're reaching out to those individuals who need our services, and we aren't deflecting or deferring or pushing people over into independent living or saying, hey, you don't really want a job, do you? After all, you've got that nice SSI or SSDI check. Why would you want to go to work? You'd lose the check. I think that with the commissions for the blind, you see an openness there to engage people where they're at and to help them.
Mm-hmm. Very well put, Greg. Yeah, I would agree with those points as well. I think if I wanted to add anything, I guess just in addition to that, the fact that the separate agencies have a dedicated staff that knows blindness, that has confidence that blind people can, you know, achieve great things and get good jobs, and I believe that we're, when I say we, I'll mostly be talking about separate agencies, commissions, etc., are really focused on the blindness issue and making sure people have the skills so that they can succeed at a job that they might get.
So you know what, Pearl? I love your mission statement in your email. I just love that you have that as your mission. Do you want to tell us the mission?
Sure, and I'll give you a little background, too. We went, for a lot of years, we were part of larger umbrella agencies, and we never had a mission statement, really. So when we became a commission, we decided it was time to develop one. And what we came up with is this: empowering blind individuals, promoting opportunities, and building belief in the blind. And that's our agency.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, Greg, knowing that, do you have a Sterling mission statement as well? Maybe
this
is
stolen pearls.
Huh?
I'm just going to now steal Pearl's mission statement, I think.
So I think that's a winning idea, is to start off with a great mission statement for, you know, helping things become better in any kind of services for people who are blind. I just really like that one. So we're gonna skip to the dirt now. They're getting bored now. So,
that was quick.
Yeah. So, what are the pitfalls? I mean, are there any things that you guys feel that you wish were better in a commission for the blind to better serve the blind?
Well, I went first last time.
Okay, I'll be glad to start with this. Mm-hmm. Of course, we don't have this problem in Nebraska.
No.
But I do think one danger, it's one of those blessing and curse things. By being a separate commission run by consumers, especially, I mean, most of them, I think, require a balance of, or at least some representation from ACB and some from NFB, and some require balance. Ours, we just have 5 board members, and 2 of them are specifically designees of those 2 organizations. The other 3 may or may not belong to anything, but even if they do, they don't represent that organization. And so the danger, I mean, the strength, of course, is then you really are answering 2 consumers, you, the agency, the bureaucrats, the service providers. We answer 2 consumers. And that's a really good thing for other reasons. The danger of it is if the politics of blindness, of the blindness organizations, that it can get in the way. Mm-hmm. That if the focus is on NFB versus ACB versus, as opposed to how can this be an effective provider of rehabilitation services, mm-hmm. Meeting the needs of blind people. The commission can kind of be killed if too much of that sort of partisan fighting goes on.
That's fascinating to me.
I concur with what Pearl has said. My commission board is 3 persons, but I also have a state rehab council. And in theory, I could close down my rehab council and just go with my 3-person board if a majority of those were blind. However, that's 2 people. And I think it's critical that we have a good cross-section of representation from the blindness community in the rehab council does that.
We also have an SRC person in here, too, just so you know, just heads up.
And I just finished one of our state plan public hearings, so we don't have a requirement that a majority be blind. So in theory, a governor could come in and put us out of compliance with the Rehab Act by appointing two-sided persons to the commission. But that's a flaw of our statute that going back and changing that might introduce more difficult issues in this current time of severe budget constraint. And my agency just went through a consolidation scare. There was a proposal to combine my agency with the Commission for the Deaf and our Governor's Commission on Disability. And the blindness community, both the NFB and the ACB, came together in very strong support of our separate status. They both passed very strong resolutions. And New Mexico has historically been identified, I think, in some respects with the NFB, just because of that was the organization that was present in New Mexico when the commission was created in 86. There wasn't really an ACB affiliate in the state until 99, which was the time I became director. And I really committed at that point to have a fair relationship with both consumer organizations. And we have enjoyed strong, good, positive relations with both. We have, and I think your rehab council member will appreciate this, I'm sure you do this in California. Here in New Mexico, we conduct public hearings at the consumer conventions of both organizations. You guys do that out there?
No.
Just when the rehab director comes in.
I like that. That's, yeah. Okay, write that one down. Okay.
Also, I have made that same commitment to attend every state convention of both organizations, and I've been fortunate enough to be asked to speak each time, but I always use my speaking time as a public forum. I say to start out with, I have things I can tell you about what we're doing, but most importantly, I really want to hear from you all, questions or comments, or, you know, this really is a public forum, and we've done that for 12 years now, and it really is important.
I like that, and I like that a lot. We had somebody from the audience wanted to hear more about it, and do you still want to hear more about it?
Yes, I did hear how the guy from the fellow from New Mexico does it.
How do you do it in New Mexico, Greg? The public hearing.
We typically I go in and I give a half hour commission report, and then after that we do a half hour public hearing. That is actually a part of the agenda, the main agenda, prime time in both consumer organizations. I started that with the NFB in 2000 and have continued that when the ACB had their first convention here. We have done it. We've had a public hearing at both organizations going in now 10 years. It is. I try to do it as an opportunity for a dialogue. If I go in and I say, okay, we now open it for public comment, and I just listen, which listening is important, but all too often I think it's important to have what Pearl described, and that's a dialogue so that people feel heard. It's important to listen actively, but I think part of listening actively involves responding to the concerns, and we do that during that public hearing time.
I like that. So you guys, Deb, Therese, and audience, help me out here with some great questions. Now Therese is going to step in here.
Okay, Trish, you got to control me.
Got to do it, okay.
Push it up. Okay, like that. Okay, can you hear me? Okay, I am Therese. I am a rehabilitation counselor for the blind for the Department of Rehab, and I am wondering if you could provide more information as when you say we have qualified staff, can you define what you mean by qualified? And then if you could describe to us how you do your intake process. So where do you find your consumers? And then once we find each other, what is the intake process on your end? And then for those consumers who have absolutely no skills, no clue in life what they want to do, how do you go through the assessment process? What tools do you use to help them identify, you know, just to develop the plan? Where are we going? What needs to be done?
Could you guys hear that?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Okay. So I'm turning this off.
Right, why don't I start? We can go back and forth for a little bit.
Right.
It's a great question, and I think it's important to take your time in the development of the plan and to be flexible in that process. Right now I'm at our orientation center, and we have students who come down here early on, and if we're doing our job correctly, when those students exit out of our program, they have a different idea as to what might be their potential. So we want to keep an open mind to individuals who want to change and identify new goals. One of the concerns that I have with the workforce system process is that they, when they look at having a joint intake system, have really an expectation that somebody will apply for services on Monday and services will start on Monday, or maybe Tuesday or maybe Wednesday, and then they get unhappy if it takes too long. So I've expressed my real concern that that, to me, is inconsistent with the Rehab Act, wherein it's a discussion that needs to take place between the counselor and the individual that requires some consideration, and it should take some time. And I think if it doesn't take time, then we're really not doing what we need to do. Now, occasionally we get people who come to us out of the starting block, and they know what they want to be, and they've known what they wanted to be since they were 11, and that might be done more quickly, and we need to be able to respond to that. But I think more often than not, we see people who come to us with diabetic retinopathy or RP or obviously, we're seeing more and more people with optic nerve hypoplasia now aging into our system. But people who come to us fairly new to blindness and not having perhaps the expectation or the understanding that blindness need not be the barrier to employment that perhaps they thought it was. And you're hearing the train go by. Brian Miller, you're going to get to hear that here soon. Earl, I'd pass it on to you to respond further.
Okay. Yeah. with the main issue for most of the clients that we serve, or most of the applicants, is that lack of understanding of blindness. They really, they've just been hit with blindness. Maybe it's been ongoing, or, you know, coming on, but it's been a fairly recent event in their life, and so they come to us and they really don't think a blind person can do anything. And they know that because they couldn't even dial the phone to call me, and they just knocked over their coffee. So they know a blind person can't do anything. Well, that's a part of our whole process, which actually that really ties back to why the importance of the separate services is that we understand the first starting point may not be what do you want to do, what kind of a job do you want. The starting point may be, and usually is, to grow that understanding that, in fact, a blind person can, you know, really do whatever type of vocation that they want. So that is a really significant difference, I believe, in the two approaches. And then I also want to talk about the qualified staff part. That was your first question, I think. We in Nebraska have a state law that the agency worked to get through and was passed, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, that sets up a certification in order to be a counselor for the blind here in Nebraska. You have to be a certified vocational rehabilitation counselor for the blind. Long-winded, but that's the way it goes. And for that, you have to complete 600 hours of immersion training and have a bachelor's degree. And we provide that training. After I hire you and say, welcome to the commission, your first 4 months, basically, is going to be in our training center, learning alternative techniques, learning the process a person goes through as they develop the confidence that these techniques really do work. And then after 4 months, you go and learn what's the job, what are the forms we use, and things like that.
You know what? That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, so with a follow-up question to that, 600 hours, I love that idea. Do your staff also learn, you know, functional vision assessments? My eye doctor, I have a background as a teacher of the visually impaired, so I'm pretty well trained in terms of somebody comes to me with an eye condition. That's great. They have retinitis pigmentosa, but really, how are they using that usable vision they have? Do your staff... You know, are they able to help identify the functional uses of that vision?
Yes. And part of our training approach is that, you know, the days, if you're in the field and not in the training center, all the days of the month that your teacher is not there with you, you're using your functional functional vision. Usually beyond what it's really helpful for, you know, the tendency to try to use the vision when it's not very effective. It's fine if you need to pick up a bill and hold it right next to your face to read it, and it's slow, but that's, you know, limited amount of reading and such. That's one thing, but if you're trying to fry an egg and you try to use the vision and, you know, lean down there to try to see it, you'll probably get some oil in your face. So I guess a lot of it's more of a counseling issue than a training issue, in that we get people to start thinking about when is the vision effective and not. And of course, it's different for every single person, even if the blindness is caused by the same condition like RP. The, you know, exact vision of Joe is going to be different from Mary's exact vision. So a lot of that's the helping the person develop their own understanding of how the vision works well for them, and where it doesn't, then you're getting the alternative techniques. In the training center, where it's 8 to 5 sleep shade training the whole time a person is there, they still have their evenings, and we have they live in apartments, and we have a counselor that is specific to the apartments. He doesn't live there. He's not an apartment monitor or supervisor, but he is there to do activities and to help the especially new clients learn things like how to function independently in an apartment. And so all of that time is with whatever vision each individual client has. So again, there's that process of kind of seeing what's going to work, what doesn't work, So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how we address it. We definitely don't just say, never use your vision. We say, you know, figure out how it's going to be useful for you. And I get the other piece of that is that and the reason that one major reason we use the sleep shades is that most of us are not going to really believe in our gut that the non-visual technique will be better. We think it's kind of a last resort, most people. And so until you actually function with not seeing, and you can really pay attention to the sounds and such, and developing your other strategies, you don't really believe it till you've done it, and done it for quite a while, which goes back to why we have such a lengthy training.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Hope that makes sense.
Impressed. you guys, more questions? What do you say?
I just want to say we only have about 20 more minutes, so if there's something that you really want to focus on. Anybody in the audience?
I have a question.
Okay, Mr. Winterstein, am I right?
Ed Crespin.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know it's the vision. Okay.
The question I have is, here in California, we have 4 centers that we may choose, or the consumer may choose to go to for pre-vocational services. That's what I call. And that's learning your braille, your typing, computer, keyboarding, independent living skills. But here in California, we do not have in the centers people who have a professional background in helping the person adjust to their loss of vision. And what I find, I'm just working with about 3 high school students right now that are losing their vision. Of course, the high schools are trying to get them out because they just want to do their thing and get their education, but they're not really working on their issues of losing more vision. So these students are not willing to learn the braille and the touch typing. They just want to use large print. And so, well, what's the community college going to do for me? Because I get all my stuff in large print. Or in some cases, I had other people who said, who are learning braille, and they said, and no braille well. They want the community college to provide everything to them in braille. But the question I have basically is, do you have either a social worker who can work with these individuals in learning, not learning, but just dealing with the loss of vision? That is real critical, because even with people who have been placed, that I have one person that I placed many years ago, and she just fought and fought and fought the idea that she was blind. And now she's, it's quite interesting, because now she's facing the issues, and it's really hard. So can you answer that?
Well, I start off first last time, so your turn.
Okay. One piece of that, it goes back to why really dedicated staff to that have blindness expertise is important. Let's see, kind of losing my train of thought here. The thing is, we all have had that training about blindness, and we know, you know, what works. We're very confident about our approach, and we know it works. Being able to express that to the client to help them kind of get it is an important aspect of what we do. I guess I'm not sure if I'm quite answering what you're getting at, so
I can kind of back on a little bit to that.
Good.
And I get to do it from a perspective that goes back to, I think, Trish, your initial question, and that is, are there any downfalls with respect to commissions for the blind? And on the phone you have Pearl Van Zandt and myself, directors of Commission for the Blind, but in relatively smaller small states, and very much smaller, of course, than California. So resources becomes an issue for the smaller states, or at least the poorer states, or the less populated states. New Mexico is the fifth largest state in the country, but we're very poor, and we have a very rural, very sparse population. So we don't have in-house a social worker that we would apply to that situation, but we certainly, I think, do an extremely good job of transition. We typically do get involved at age 14, and one of the programs that I implemented 3 years ago was a what we call our Technology for Children program, where we receive $80,000, which is a lot for a state like New Mexico with shade under 2 million residents, to provide assistive technology to blind kids. We also are quite receptive to providing assistive technology to blind high school seniors on the basis that we recognize it would help them to hit the ground running if they're going to transition to college. So that gives the school districts incentive to work with us and helps us to intervene, and we'll provide video magnifiers if it's appropriate, or pack mates or braille notes, and we certainly will share our opinion as to what we think is the appropriate device or approach given the individual's vision. We have certainly very difficult situations with acceptance of blindness and visual impairment, and we see that particularly amongst kids and families, and probably most particularly in some of the Native American communities, where even the word blind, as in Navajo community, saying a person is blind is culturally taboo. So how we approach that is of great delicacy and sensitivity.
Wow. I'll tell you, the folks in the audience that are working with the youth are clapping, just so you know. They like the 14 idea.
Well, we start at 14, but we serve kids, you know, toddlers.
We
work very closely with our School for the Blind, and we give a lot of eyeglasses out because that's part of this $80,000, which in California would be close to a little over $1 million, if you can imagine having $1 million of technology to distribute to blind children who would have no way of getting it otherwise. And we see it as helping braille literacy, helping with development, helping them to prepare to enter into our program.
Wonderful.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm Joe Jarrus. I'm Supervisor of Social Services at Vista Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired in Palo Alto. And we have a program where we do a lot of support groups and classes in adjusting to vision loss, and also one-on-one counseling. And I just wonder if you partner ever with other agencies in New Mexico to provide some of that kind of support, if that's not something that you're doing directly?
Hard for me to hear, and I'll take that because it's my turn, and Pearl can respond about Nebraska. But did you ask if we partner with other private agencies?
Yes, who might do some of that counseling or run support groups or that kind of thing, and work with you on the emotional aspects of adapting to vision loss?
Good to hear it, Greg.
Yes.
Okay.
Do we partner with organizations and support groups to help adapt to some of the emotional issues with loss of vision? We do help sponsor support groups through our independent living program. We've got 13 that we work with throughout New Mexico. We see that as being really critical. Those tend to be an older population that get involved in that. We do actively work with both consumer organizations. Here in New Mexico, the Commission for the Blind, not counting the School for the Blind, are really it in terms of organized programs. There are no Lighthouse programs or Societies for the Blind or any entity like that doing business here. Of course, there's the Veterans Association and their blind program. But we do provide counseling when it's appropriate, and we identify and work with counselors. Here at our orientation center, we have an active relationship with a mental health program here. So when there are issues that relate to that, we do actively work with them.
Thank you.
She says thank you.
Nebraska, it's very similar in Nebraska. There are no, there really are no private agencies for the blind here, which is quite different than the bigger states. But certainly we partner with consumer organizations and we partner with other entities that might serve people who might be blind, like the VA, but also senior, the Agency on Aging type of thing. So, yes, we certainly partner as much as possible with many agencies or entities and educational institutions, but they none of them are really for the blind. I wanted to make another point, if I could, that I didn't really speak to, but when we became a commission, it really was because both organizations in Nebraska worked together to make it happen. And, you know, I talked about that some of the dangers can be if the agents, if the two organizations are kind of at each other's throat. But that also can be a very strengthening aspect, and we would not be a commission. I'm sure the commission bill would never have passed if it weren't for consumers of both major organizations and some who weren't, didn't belong to any organization, knowing a good thing when they saw it, basically, and working together to make that happen. I just wanted to make sure that was a point that I'm...
It's a good point. It's a great point. So
I could also add to that, one of the things that you see the Commissions for the Blind doing is providing advocacy. That's a very significant part of our mission, although it's a small part of our time. And you don't see that in the combined agencies or the general agencies or in our state, even our separate division of vocational rehabilitation. I wrote an op-ed piece in our Albuquerque Journal that addressed some changes to our paratransit system, and I was highly critical of those changes. And I have the ability to make those arguments and those presentations that simply would not be the case in a combined or consolidated agency. I've been chairing a task force that's dealing with the issues of quiet cars that came out of a memorial from our legislative session this past year. And we're looking at solutions with those hybrid electric vehicles. And that's something where the two organizations have worked collaboratively on. There are a number of advocacy areas that I've involved myself in that you just would not see if you didn't have the Commission for the Blind structure.
Interesting.
Right.
How much time do we have left, you guys?
5 minutes.
Can
I have one question?
Okay, how many people do have questions? So you got to say it out loud. I'll never see your hands. Okay, good. You got Ed here. He's going to ask our last question.
Should I grab that mic again?
They can't hear you.
Here, I'll get Ed the mic here. All right. Oh, it is. Okay, turn off. Okay, we got our last question. He's going to make it a good one.
Yep, this is Ed Crespin again. Here in California, we have a process through the RSA that we have the statuses, the numbers. You know, you have the 02, 06, 10, 18, 26, 28. And for those who are out there, those are the status codes to put people through the process. But my question is, the status to his application, And generally here in California, if persons receiving SSI, SSD, either pretty much are pretty much have their foot in the door to go into status 10, which is being eligible for services. Then, of course, from that point, we go into the A team, which is making the plan, creating the plan. My question is, it seems to be more of a rush system that we have here to get people into plan very quickly without making proper assessments as to what skills do they really have, what vocational goal are they really going to be capable of reaching, and what kind of training is really going to be necessary. Do you have those stressors of getting people into plan as we have here in California?
Question.
Okay. I forget who started last.
I think I did.
Okay, I'll go first then. Yeah. We do have that same process of the 2, the 10, and so forth. And we have certain timelines. I can't tell you off the top of my head what those are, but we have all of those things. But we, you know, it's more about getting, building a, for the counselor to build the rapport with the client and to start to assist them in starting to figure out what their goals really are and what their, you know, whatever barriers are there to get past those. There is, you can always change your goal. In other words, if you develop a plan, it doesn't have to match what you eventually get a job as. Most of us, well, even when you first go to college, much less younger, you know, is what I'm doing today, what I went to school for. Maybe not, you know, that's pretty typical just in the population as a whole. And so even more so for a blind person who doesn't even know if they could do whatever job it might be, as you move through your rehabilitation process, you very well may change that goal. And we think that's perfectly fine. You can amend the plan and set a new goal. We try not to have, say, somebody that just wants to go to school forever changing their plan every time they, you know, decide they want to take up basket weaving instead of, you know, nuclear science. But so we have flexibility within the system for the person.
As do we, and I think that one of the things that we see is that people spend time in plan for long periods of time. Part of that, most of that, is because of our outreaching to kids at age 14, but much of that is because people come in, we support them to go to school if they want to go on to get a graduate degree. We support that, really with no argument or obstruction. We will discuss with them what their goals are, and we're very willing to further those goals and help them to hone in on what those are. But we'll see people who are in service for 10 years. That's not at all unusual as we help people through graduate school.
Right. Same here.
You guys have been such wonderful people to do this with us today, and I just want to give you guys both a round of applause. And also just, do you have any closing comments?
We just encourage you to consider the benefits of a Commission for the Blind status and the way in which separate agencies work, and Pearl and I are both part of the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind, and we would love to see California really actively and fully participate in that and become an agency along the same vein as ours. Obviously, we want blind people to be served in the very best possible fashion.
Right.
Amen to that.
You're commendable people, very great people. So thanks for being who you are, and thank you so much for doing this with us today. So one
Our
more
pleasure.
Round of applause. And thank you.
And I think everyone could hear us well, because I didn't hear issues with that. So I commend you on your ability to make this conference call work.
It was a lot, and you were great putting up with it all. It was a challenge, trust me. We were really, we had some great helpers in the room, though, that came to our rescue and really stood by. We almost didn't get it going, so.
Well, you did a great job.
You guys are a great group, and we really appreciate what you do out there, and we see the benefit across the nation, and the council out there is doing great things, and we appreciate that.
Okay, you guys, I'll let you get back to your hard working days here, because I know you have a lot of work to get done.
All right, have a good afternoon, folks.
Okay, bye, all. I'm afraid to touch it now. So what did you guys think of all that?
Very good.
You like that?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I learned a couple things that I thought were really great, which mainly were about more immersion, especially for people that work with people who are blind, and just that would be amazing. And public hearing, having more dialogue, and then ways that we can figure out some problem solving to be better. I think at the conventions, I think would be really great. I just think more immersion of consumers in general at the conventions, that, you know, if we can promote that as much as possible through our jobs, you know, to make sure that they get more empowered that way. They get more peer support. You know, they can learn how to know their rights. And I you know, those are things that I think about a lot, about how we could at least be better currently, even if we didn't have a commission for the blind, that, you know, there's ways that we can work with this, too, and incorporate those things, too. So what other comments you guys have? Anything?
Pearl's mission statement again.
She believes in empowering. Their mission statement is about empowering the blind. It's providing opportunities to people who are blind, and also to believe in them. To have belief. And I think that those are really core things to offer. And I really think that, you know, like when we're just talking about immersion, but, you know, you have to. When people are new to blindness, I mean, they just don't know anybody, and they really need to be immersed into a setting like conventions like this, so that they can really meet people and learn and figure out, you know, what this is all about, and then try to use that to their advantage so they can get ahead. I just think we have to.
I think, Trish, this is Debbie Bacon. I think the thing that caught me, my mind's been buzzing ever since the conversation stopped, but the business about having staff come in and give them 4 months of in-depth training, and that to me is the bottom line right there.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm seeing, I have a unique perspective. I was asked to be on this committee because I'm a consumer,
right.
But I'm also in a delicate position of being in training to be a counselor. And I've only been doing the fieldwork training for 4 weeks, and it's sad because what I heard for years before has been validated in so many little tiny ways. And let me tell you guys, these aren't big things. They're little tiny minuscule things that could be changed like a light switch turned off and on. But the mindset is so not there. It's disturbing. And there's no reason for it. There's absolutely no reason for it. The only thing that I would say that Teresa and I were discussing is that when you're in a small state, now they were talking about not having funds, but when you're in a small state, it's easier to work with a smaller group of people. And we have such a large, diverse state that's so complicated.
Yes.
And it makes things much more difficult. And I hear it in my classes right now. My program is through San Diego State University's online master's program. So I hear from people all over the United States who are working either in rehab offices now or in social service offices. And I'll tell you, if I wasn't having this mad desire to do this because of my own personal experiences and the people that I've met in this room over the last 10 or 15 years, I wouldn't want to do it. They are so frustrated and so depressed and feel so pushed to push cases through, which was another thing that caught my ear about slowing up the process. And all you hear is, push it through, push it through. I have to push it through. I have to get a 26 on this. Like, you know, it's amazing. It's just amazing to me. And again, I think it comes down to the initial training. When someone comes in the door, the training is key. The exposure is key. The modeling is key. And it's just not there right now. Mm-hmm. Not here.
Mm-hmm. Those are great comments, Deb. Mm-hmm. So, anything else from you guys?
Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Alice McGrath, and I also work at Vista Center, and I am a member of the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind, and I'm also a consumer, and I've been a part of DOR three times in my life. So my question is very, I've heard it, I came from the East Coast, so I'm a product of a commission for the blind. And what, if you had to just say in a sentence why California is not a commission for the blind, what would that sentence be? Why we don't have it?
Funding.
You can't get it through the legislature.
Is it funding?
It's money. Yeah, it's a lot of money to start up a new structure. That's what it is. Yeah.
We're never going to get it down.
I think
wasn't that our goal with SB 105 though, and we had to cut back because of the budget cut back then in 2000.
I mean, they're always going to say we don't have money, though. They're always. I've never lived a life, I mean, a day yet when I haven't heard something like that, you know. So, but I think that they were just saying you can save money through it, too.
Well, I mean, for example, the average wage of individuals with achievement employment outcome in New Mexico is $21.55 for black guys.
But that's
per hour?
That's per hour. That's the average wage.
And where?
In Mexico. Professional, all kinds of teachers, attorneys, you know, service. I mean, you know.
That's amazing.
Is that good or whatever? Is that good or bad?
That's very good.
Yeah.
It's about $8 more, I think.
I think we're $19 is ours or something like that. On the whole of the agency, though, I think it is. I don't think it's about blindness. I'm not sure. Maybe it is blindness only. But anyway, yeah, it's still, yeah, it's still a tough gig, let me tell you. It's not easy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my daughter Gail works for Vista. But just another line of thought to introduce in this discussion is advocacy through the legislature. How does that system work? Does it come from, does DOR get involved through, and do they have regular discussions, online discussions?
Actually, Brian, being on the Blind Advisory Committee, might want to take that one, working with legislature and advocacy.
Well, when the system works right, and when the Department of Rehab produces consumers who are happy with services, the result is there are lots of advocates to help our state's VR system go forward with the legislature. That has not happened in recent years. And in recent years, we've had this adversarial relationship. One of the reasons why New Mexico, although it's a poor state, has done so well is because they produce satisfied customers who go and help Greg Kraft, you've heard, when things like combined agencies get raised as a possible cost-saving measure. And I think as we go forward, if we can help build a culture where consumers finish their rehab training and they aren't just at their end of their rope, they see it as a war against counselors, supervisors, but instead see that partnership that we often give lip service to, the Department of Rehab is going to have a lot of people in its corner when it comes time to avoid the things that we've seen, furloughs for an agency that's almost entirely federally funded. What's up with that?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot I can talk about, really, but I think the day of seeing ourselves together as partners and understanding, I actually don't believe that the reason we don't have a commission is money. I mean, we spend tens of millions of dollars on blind field services.
Mm-hmm.
It is the tension between the philosophy saying cross disability, everybody should drink from the same well here at the department, versus the specialized services, the kind of things that we see on the Blind Advisor Committee. With the exception of Patricia, supervisor after supervisor are hired without experience in blindness. No. Counselor after counselor is coming from places where they don't know what end of the cane to hold. And I wish I could hear a little bit more from some of the other commission states about how they build a staff with that kind of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard because we're sitting in a room where the best of DOR is here already, but it's maybe, what, 8 DOR employees out of your 10% DOR blind services here. Where are the other 90%? Why are not they here? What is more important than sitting in this room today?
Thanks, Brian. Well, I think you're great. No, I think that's wonderful.
I want to say something. Teresa and I were talking about this before we came to this meeting. What is the problem? And what Brian was saying is exactly what we talked about. The counselors need to be required to come to these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to be one of their job requirements,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise they won't.
Debbie, I complained about this for years when I was a chair of this committee, saying supervisors, Trisha knows, but supervisors in the past should have unit meetings here. They should all go to CSUN and FBC and CCB at least once a year. It should be a requirement. Like, they don't get paid unless they go.
I know that. But it's like there's only two conferences a year.
It's
That's
not my
it.
Job attitude.
Oh, yeah.
I think we have seen those who have passion for what we believe in and those who, it's just a job.
Well,
I see it.
And the SB 105 training, which is required by staff every year, a third of them don't go and aren't accounted to say, hey, what happened, or did you get recordings of it, can I sit and listen to that? They're never held accountable to getting the facts after the training that they missed. And that's a waste of our taxpayer dollars, $100,000 or more a year.
And I would like to learn more on the Nebraska certification. $600. Is that like a VI program?
All I know, I was talking to her about that. I have $600 required for my master's in rehab, but there is very little about vision going on in that program.
No.
And, in fact, just one little tiny example, in the medical portions, part one, part two, I looked at my schedule. VI isn't even discussed till the last 2 weeks of the program.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, all this other stuff is discussed, which is, I'm not belittling it, that it's not important. But it shows that the focus is definitely not there on a national basis, even with an academic end of it. And if the focus doesn't start there, that's where all these people are coming from. They're coming from the universities and the colleges where they're switching careers midlife. They don't have any exposure at all. If they're not getting any kind of modeling exposure in the university setting and the education setting, they're definitely not going to get it on the street. So where are they getting it from? That's why we were talking about we've got to get these people to these meetings. Once a year would be pretty good.
See a resolution on the table.
Yeah. Well, all the people in this room ran the SB 105 meetings. We might have some good output. But it's
seriously, a resolution might be a very good idea.
I think we've had one.
We probably had them, but what? You have to do the again. Same resolutions every few years because you have new personnel, you have new people.
Mm-hmm.
I talked on the floor, and I think it was either Brenda Primo or Tony. This was about 3 years ago, and I did mention that this is a really good training center for a lot of rehab counselors to come to, and I encouraged them to encourage supervisors to send counselors to these conventions. And it's just like you keep talking about it, but nothing happens. You could do a resolution, it still doesn't happen. I agree with Brian, it has to be a culture of change. It has to be a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
If we rehab, blind field service is going to change, the philosophy has to change within the entire unit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is Linda Johnson. I'm a counselor at Vista Center for the Blind.
And it's a little off this topic, but I agree with all this. I think it's just so super. I mean, it would just be amazing to have that, you know, centralized structure. And I'm just wondering, is there any, I mean, like with the commissions, is there any literature or any how do you do it, how the frameworks for how to start, like the foundation and building it?
You need some strong advocates that are connected to the legislature, just mm-hmm. like the man was alluding to over there. And you have to get organized. The two groups need to be very organized, the CCB and NFB.
Yeah.
And everybody's got to want it really badly, and it's got to be connected to the politicians to make that significant change. Now, Catherine Skivers, as we know, is a fantastic advocate, and she was one of the key people, along with Jim Willows.
And then we had John Burton on our side, too.
And John Burton was there, and that's how they got the division. Now, the division for the blind is better than not, although it's chaotic nonetheless still, as you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, thank God, you know, they got as far along as they did, and it took so much sweat and so much, it was draining to get what they got, and I want to commend them for that because they deserve that for everything they've done, but we still need to pull it along a little further.
Patricia, ironically, you know who may be one of the best advocates down the line for changes? Well, consumers, but Jerry Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Who ran
That's true.
Who was a very strong advocate for rehab when he was governor.
Yes, you're right about that. So
appointed a lot of very good people to the consumer commissions and stuff.
Right.
Came to meetings. I was actually at several meetings where he listened to consumers.
Right.
And they gave him an earful, too. So I'm just saying, mm-hmm. maybe the political situation will change.
That's true. That is a good point, actually.
I was going to respond to I've been listening to all the different issues. I've tried to look at all the different people that are associated with the departments.
I've made a point of listening to as many people as possible to kind of understand all the different problems going on, and it's really like an octopus. I mean, I talked to counselors, talked to the director, deputy directors, DAs, obviously a lot of consumers, service providers, and there are a tremendous number of issues and problems. And what I would recommend as chair of the SRC is, like you were saying, to come together as a group and kind of prioritize the problems or the issues that you have, and most importantly, come up with a set of solutions to solve the problems. Because I probably hear maybe 70% problems and maybe 30% solutions.
Uh-huh.
And I really think it needs to turn around because, you know, I've been on the council for almost 3 years. I don't think we've ever had one blind consumer come to an SRC meeting.
Uh-huh.
And it's a public meeting, and we're there to listen, to understand the problems, and listen to the solutions so that we can make recommendations. So it's a really a two-way street.
Right.
You know, and I'm not just saying that because I'm on the council.
No, it's fantastic,
but
you are.
So I really encourage you and everybody you know to look at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, you've got equipment delivery problems. You know, counselors don't understand disabilities.
Right. People, you know, pick up phones and all this stuff going on.
It's just a maze of problems.
Right. What do you think of this idea then? Do you think we could do something like have a hearing at the next, at our next like rehab committee, like in San Diego? When we haven't designed it yet or picked out an idea, but could we have like SRC and people present? We could do like all the consumers could come and speak, and we could put a problem solving day on or something.
You know, I'm meeting with Joe Xavier in 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be happy to. I'll definitely suggest that.
I think that'd be
to
fun.
Him. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We might have to change the time. I'd like to get more people involved. Obviously, I want to give people, you know,
we can do
consumers.
A Saturday morning workshop.
Really?
Yeah.
If we actually did it,
that might be good.
People
right.
could come maybe in or early on Thursday, because a Thursday is it would probably be the best day. But if we had an all-day working session,
But when that happens, like I said, if you come with the issues and the solutions,
right,
so we can take those down and push them forward. But it's just that we're overwhelmed with so many problems, and we have to figure out the solution. Yeah. The only way we can figure out the solutions is like for me to come here and listen to you. This is Brian Connors, the chair of the SRC.
Once we hear the problem, we have to have the whole audience participate in the solution, and then we write it down, and then we stick to a plan that we're going to implement that. The audience would vote, would you like to implement that plan? We get a yay or nay, and then we move to the next one.
Tricia, could this be a joint hearing between SRC and BAC? Because I think we don't get enough exposure.
I would love
to BAC,
that. Definitely. Everybody. Yeah, Brian? Yeah?
Yes.
Brian.
Thank you.
State Rehabilitation Council.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about
thank
that.
Thank you.
And the BAC is the Blind Advisory Committee? Committee, Council. One thing I would also suggest, this is Brian Miller, is that, I mean, currently there is a vacancy in the position of Deputy Director for the Special Services for the Blind and Deaf position. As a committee that is concerned about services provided by that division, it seems to me now would be an extraordinarily opportune time for you all to think about what it is you would want from somebody who would be appointed to that position. That is a gubernatorial appointment, and as such, is subject, there should be subject anyway, to the input from consumer groups, not least of which this group right here, right? So you all should be thinking about and drafting some things that you would like to see in a leader of that division, somebody who is committed to blind services, somebody who knows blindness, whatever it is you want to see, somebody who... but something to think about, because in the interim, the road to a commission is definitely a long and a challenging one. But in the interim, you do have an opportunity to have some say in the very immediate future for that division.
True.
And Brian, do you think that appointment will happen within this year?
Well. What I hear is they want to fill the position quickly.
Really? I didn't hear that. Wow. Okay, wow.
The position is the deputy director.
Have they actually opened it?
Yes.
Oh, it is.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is actually. You go to the governor's website, and it's under appointments.
Wow.
Every one of you could apply right now.
We've got to get on. Got to like to get whipped around a lot, too, So did anybody else want to make some comments? But I do want to talk more about putting this on at the next convention, like on a Saturday morning, where we really actually have this huge forum, Blind Advisory Committee, SRC, consumers, all the nonprofits, just everybody come together, people from rehab, and we really have a problem-solving day. Problem and then solve it. Problem and solve it. And then we have to implement it.
Yeah, this is Ed Crespin. I have a question. What's the possibility? Because when we have people applying for counselor positions, and I'm going to be careful with what I say here, too. Some of the questions that they have are pretty broad questions, talking about counseling skills and what would you do with this situation, what you would do with that situation. But they should have at least two questions about talking, especially if a person has a visual impairment, but also with a person who doesn't have a visual impairment. They need to identify issues of how they would solve some problems with, some of the other areas of Braille, typing, computer skills, and something like that. Because I've seen in the past, I've been here 18 years with rehab, and I've seen in the past some of the brightest, greatest blind folks, but their skills are really bad.
Well, I'm looking at this. I'm interviewing people now. So, and you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking up. The upshot is I just want somebody who's a hard worker and has got a good heart. And then, if we had an immersion program, they could learn the rest. So, those are what I'm trying to pick up in their character. She's got it. She stole it. She's
I
I have a question. I came here a little bit late, and I'm very amazed and interested in what I'm hearing. I'm learning many things, and my specific issue is hopefully speaking to somebody after this meeting. I've recently had an experience with DR that was quite amazing. Very quickly after applied and thought that having had services way back, at a point now in my life where my vision is really so bad that I really do need to use all the things I've heard about and know of, never used them, but now I do need to use them because of the extent of my vision loss. But I was denied services, and in a nutshell, kind of just basically told you're too disabled. There will be no benefit to society or economy for you to have services. And I'd like to understand that more, but it just seems so ironic to me. And it's like, now that I'd like to go back to work, and actually what happened was, right, I didn't know this was going to happen. I got the shingles afterwards, after applying. Wow. And I think that influenced the person to think, oh, you just simply can't do anything at this time. And it was like, well, but I'd like to know how to overcome this.
So did someone told you that you were too disabled for our services?
Essentially, because the letter said there's no economic.
Okay,
what she said to me.
That's terrible, and that should not be, because we're supposed to help you first and give you opportunity and see what we can do. We have to prove, you know, it's back on us to see, you know, hey, we have services and we have to see how we can help you back.
I've used them before.
Yeah.
I have much more vision loss now
I've
known of them. I haven't used them. I've seen other people use them. I know a little bit about them, but I haven't needed to use them until now.
Okay, I understand. So you need the services so you can build up your skills and you need the opportunity.
Yes, retraining.
To do that. And we should not be sending letters like that.
Yeah. Well, if I can talk to someone afterwards, it'd be wonderful to help me to understand how to go. Alicia.
Alicia. Okay.
Thank you.
My name's Tricia, and I should talk to you after. I'm afraid you're probably in my unit or something. I'm in Oakland, and I go all the way down to Santa Cruz and Monterey, Salinas. We go to Menlo Park. And
are you seriously hiring me?
I'm hiring two people, one for the School for the Blind and one in Oakland, and a Richmond position will be opening up. Since Barbara Messinger, our dear soul, great person, she passed away. I don't know if you guys know all that, but I hope it didn't surprise you. I do have an email, yes, and I have phone, too.
Could you give me?
Yes, I will. Okay, everybody. Okay, here's my phone. It's 510-622-2930. It's 510-622-2930. Okay, and I have an email. And so my formal name is Patricia. So it's, and my last name is Leetz. It's L-E-E-T-Z. So my email goes as follows. Pleetz, P-L-E-E-T-Z, @dor.ca.gov. You guys probably know the tune.
She's doing the work of four councils right now.
Huh? I'm doing four caseloads in my job right now.
Awesome.
But I...
You've already seen the difference.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Things are changing.
Well, you can quadruple your 26s.
You're right.
But yeah, and definitely, those are the sorts of stories that, you know, I actually, we had a Barbara Messinger that passed away, and many of you know her. I assigned some counselors out to for the consumers, and some of them call me back like, I am going to CAP if I have to take that person. And I'm like, okay, then you won't be going with that person. And then I was like, okay, if your last name starts with Q or X, because there are no Qs or Xs, you'll be working with blah blah blah. But you know, it's kind of like, come on, that's just inappropriate that we have a staff that nobody wants to go to.
Did Brian,
you know?
I have one comment to make before. Again, this is Ed Crespin, and to address the issue about a person being too disabled for our services, if the disability is a temporary thing. You know, we are patient. We are waiting. Shingles is one of those situations. However, we also have people who are diabetic, brittle diabetics, and I've had a couple of people on my caseload that were extremely brittle. And it is a fine line as to how far can we really help this individual. And this is where the consumer has to really sit down and think, with my disabling condition, am I really going to be placeable? We could train the heck out of somebody, but you also have to think about placing, and that's a real hard, fine line to deal with. And I agree with what the person said from Riverside. We do have consumers who are in programs and are just there because they want the transportation. But that's not what we're here for. And those individuals who are doing that, really think about, are they really, really sincere wanting to work?
What do you guys think? Should we wind it up here? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was fun to get together, huh?
Thank you, Krista.
and we have another idea for our next round here, to do some problems, hear the problems and solve them and come together all around that. And that would be great if you could talk to Joe Xavier or Brian, because we have so many Brians in the audience. This is Brian Connors from the SRC. And, you know, if we could put something together like that, bringing all the groups and everybody together for, like, a morning session, that'd be amazing.
And let Frank know, because then he'll get the word out.
That's true, too. Exactly. We'll definitely have to – we have some time to publicize it. But so let's see what we can strategize here and pull something together.
Thank you.
All right, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.